Welcome. This is Christian Peterson, and you're listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Thanks for joining us. I just finished talking with Sadia Sheikh about her wonderful new book, Sufi Narratives of Intimacy, Ibn Arabi, Gender, and Sexuality, which was published with University of North Carolina Press in 2012. Many Muslim debates regarding women are solely situated in legal or political frameworks. For example, we often find this tendency in conversations about women's leadership in the mosque or the politics of veiling. Sadia Sheikh provides a unique approach to these discussions that puts feminist hermeneutics in dialogue with the thought of the prolific author Muhyiddin Ibn Arabi. In Sufi Narratives of Intimacy, she explores contestations over embodiment and gender, spirituality and leadership, sexuality and power, in order to rethink patriarchal epistemologies in contemporary Muslim discourses. She argues that contesting positions on gender in these debates are underpinned by certain assumptions about human nature, its gendering, and existence. Sheikh outlines the social and ritual consequences of spiritual inequality and initiates reflections on Islamic notions of the central category, human being. Sheikh leads us through Ibn Arabi's dynamic anthropology, ontology, and cosmology, linking the abstract philosophical concepts with concrete daily relationships between men and women. In our conversation, we discuss Islamic feminism, apophatic unsayings and hermeneutics of subversion, Ibn Arabi's interpersonal relationships with women, parallels between the macrocosm and the microcosm, Muslim exegesis, notions of creation, interpretations of Adam and Eve and Jesus' birth from the Virgin Mary, and notions of masculine and feminine Islam. It was really wonderful to talk to Sadia Sheikh, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thanks for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Sadia Sheikh about her great book, Sufi Narratives of Intimacy, Ibn Arabi, Gender, and Sexuality. Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Christian.
And I guess even though it's morning for me, it's afternoon for you. So thanks for making the time. We're long distance, so it's been harder to get everything together. But I appreciate your patience, and I appreciate you making the time.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute privilege, Christian.
Now, this really is a wonderful book. I am a big fan of Ibn Arabi, and I think anyone who is interested in Islamic studies in general will really benefit from this, because you really bring Ibn Arabi out of this kind of very narrow focus of Islamic mysticism and bring him into this kind of wider kind of array of uses. And I think you've done a wonderful job, and I really think a lot of people will benefit from reading your book, and I hope they go out and buy it, of course, or at least get their hands on it to read it. So, but before we get into the content of the book, can you give us a little bit of background about how you got interested in the study of Islam, perhaps people that have been influential in your approach, or perhaps why you began to study Islam?
Thank you, Christian. I was initially used to read religious studies and Islamic studies just as fun. I was majoring in private law and in psychology, and had ideas of either becoming a social justice human rights lawyer, and later on thought, no, law bored me to tears, and I would become a psychologist, which was far more interesting. Be that as it may, Ibrahim Musa was a student, a graduate student in psychology at the time, and Ibrahim Musa, who's currently at Duke University, and was at that time based at the University of Cape Town, came and presented a paper on gender issues in Islam at a camp, actually at a youth camp, a Muslim youth camp that I was at. And I was actually quite taken aback, because it was the first time there was somebody addressing from within a faith perspective critically questions around gender. And so what I was used to hearing was how Islam liberated women. And as much as I deeply wanted to believe that, the evidence around me was to the contrary. So Ibrahim was the first person that actually, from within a faith framework, who was a believer, who came across as a committed Muslim, was simultaneously quite critical of questions of gender. And so I started a series of conversations with him and ended up coming to the University of Cape Town to do to study with him in Islamic studies. So that's really kind of what got me interested, was this ability to be both an insider within a tradition and yet critically engage with issues of gender in the way that he appeared to be doing. And so Ibrahim Musa was quite influential. I mean, he's still somebody I consider a mentor and somebody that I, you know, kind of consult with on the occasions that I can. But it was really his work. And I mean, once I was here as a graduate student at the University of Cape Town, one of the other people that became really important in my thinking was Amina Wadud. And she had come down, as many of you might know, to give a conference to South Africa. And I was part of that kind of 1994, where she presented the first talk at the Claremont Main Road Mosque. And that was quite deeply significant for me, participating in that Jumu'ah, hearing a woman who I thought was an authority grappling with questions of gender in a way that was, for me, characterized by both integrity, commitment to the tradition, and yet a kind of a critical and a very analytical approach. So these, Ibrahim Musa, Amina Wadud were fairly central in my kind of early development and people that got me excited. And then, of course, I became familiar with the works of Rifat Hassan and other people, and that those were kind of formative influences in my life.
Now, you've published a lot of very important works, and I'm wondering if you could talk about when did this specific project begin to develop as a book, and perhaps you can place it in your larger research trajectory.
I always kind of think very fondly to this experience. Actually, my first reading of Ibn al-Arabi was in a course that I was doing when I was in the U.S. I was a graduate student at Temple University. I had gone there on a Fulbright scholarship, and very kindly the people at the University of Pennsylvania had allowed me to take courses at UPenn as well. So I was doing this wonderful semester where I was doing a graduate course at Temple in Sufism, and that very semester they were offering a graduate course in Sufism at Penn, and I did both of them. And one of the people that was in the class with me at the time, who was also my Arabic TA, was a woman that I think you've done an interview with her here, is Sarah Tlili. And Sarah and I were, on the one hand, she was teaching me Arabic in my Arabic classes, and on the other hand, she was in my class in this course that we did on Sufism. And we then would make time, we became good friends, and we would make time to read Ibn al-Arabi or just do different Sufism readings together. And my very first experience of Ibn al-Arabi was when Sarah and I were sitting in her Rez room at the time, and we were reading Ibn al-Arabi, and actually we were reading it in the Arabic and reading it in the English, and then she on occasion said to me, oh, read the English, the Arabic is pure Greek to her. And so we would kind of go between the English and the Arabic. But my most defining memory of that first experience of reading Ibn al-Arabi directly, not through secondary sources, but reading him, was that both of us at some point looked up and the sun had set and time had passed, and we hadn't realized that about 4 or 5 hours had gone past. And it was that moment of just feeling transported by the ideas of this thinker. And really, they weren't ideas on gender, very interestingly. They were very much his central concepts on what it means to be a human being. Notions on Insan Kamil, on human, on essentially what was his central imaginary of the human being. Which both of us were completely compelled by and just both transported. And we both literally at some point kind of looked around, almost startled that, time had passed, my meter, my car meter that I had put money into, I had lost track of that, and time had passed. It was a genuinely transporting reading. And that was before I discovered that he was so fascinating in terms of gender. That was part of where I started reading Ibn Arabi. And as this went on, I then was, at that point, I was still doing coursework for my PhD. As the time came when I finished up coursework and my comprehensive exams, I was chatting with and discussing with my professor, who was my supervisor, Professor Mahmoud Ayyub, at Temple University, and we were talking about a variety of different things. And then I said to him, I'm really compelled by Ibn Arabi, and I feel like I would really like to work on his ideas on gender. And Professor Mahmoud, who was the loveliest man, turned to me in the sweetest and gentlest of voices and said, "Dear Saadia, leave Ibn Arabi for later in your career. We want a PhD that can get done." And I very respectfully, in fact, was a bit relieved, because I said to him, "Well, okay, fine. I will then leave him and I will try and write on something else and leave him for later in my career. And off I went on my merry way and tried to write a couple of different research proposals on a number of different people. And for some reason, it just didn't work. Nothing seemed to work until finally I came back to him and I said, okay, you know, I've been trying to do this stuff on Tafsir. I've tried working with Tabari and Zamakhshari and nothing seems to really grab me. And given the fact that I'm still quite compelled with Ibn Arabi, do you think perhaps I could maybe do a comparison between Ghazali and Ibn Arabi, which gives me a little bit less depth with Ibn Arabi? And that way, you know, I can kind of compare very specific things and I don't have to become, you know, too involved in the complexity of this very, very difficult and abstruse thinker. And then he kind of grudgingly agreed to that. And I spent a lot of time writing some stuff on Ghazali and researching it and getting it done. And then I started with Ibn Arabi. And when I finally got into the depth of Ibn Arabi in terms of gender stuff, I realized there was just no way that one could compare an ocean and a rivulet. No, all respect due to Al-Ghazali, but they were just very different thinkers, and there was just no way to be thinking, despite the fact that they both wrote on Islamic mysticism. They were writing from very different imaginaries of gender, and I just couldn't find an overlap or a way to do justice to either of them if it was going to be comparative. And that's how my PhD work, at least, ended up solely focused on Ibn Arabi. I have all of the chapters that I worked on for Ghazali in a nice box that I, you know, am now revisiting. So that was the beginning of my journey with Ibn Arabi. And I have a fairly crude kind of image that comes to mind whenever I think of Ibn Arabi. I think I'm almost bitten. Like I almost didn't have a choice. Like I, you know, really tried to do other things and work on other people. But almost like he had caught me by the scruff of my neck and said, you can do this. And so I submitted.
I think he has that effect on a lot of people.
Indeed.
Now, Sadia, the book physically is beautiful. University of North Carolina Press did a wonderful job in publishing the book physically, but it's also written very beautifully. And I wanted to ask you, because I haven't found this in a lot of other books, but in many sections, you retell and set a scene for us, almost in a kind of a creative nonfiction. And I'm wondering if you could kind of reflect upon that and perhaps what is the value of telling good stories for academics? Many of the books we read are very boring, for lack of a better word, but your book reads very well. And I'm wondering if you could just talk about why you did that and how you think that communicates your ideas successfully.
Christian, thank you very much for that question, primarily because I spend so much time working on the writing that I'm very pleased to answer that question. And I think I wrote it just incidentally. It took me 2 years to just work on writing it in that particular fashion. And there was a real intellectual motive for it. On the one hand, as some people might know, Ibn Arabi is often, you know, talked about and written about by a fairly small group of scholars. He is difficult. He's extremely difficult to understand. And unless there's some kind of deep, deep connection you have with his work, or you're a particular kind of intellectual, often his ideas are quite impossible to understand. So one of the reasons that I really was committed to making the writing accessible was because I thought here were the most exquisite ideas which were in circulation with a small group of intellectuals who could make sense of this. And really, there was value for this with a whole host of other group. You know, it had value for lots of other people. And part of my commitment was to be able to draw people into the thinking of Ibn Arabi by writing in a way that could engage them and could kind of make it accessible. So part of the writing that I worked really hard for was, you know, to create a story, a more kind of narrative style, was to engage people who would otherwise find him genuinely inaccessible. And so the creative writing is the idea to draw people into his worldview and to make the effort or the intellectual effort that is demanded of when you're reading Ibn Arabi just slightly more worthwhile for people who might otherwise think, well, this is just really too difficult. So that was the first thing. It was a question of, you know, what is my commitment? And my commitment is to make him accessible on the one hand. And the other thing is that, you know, academic work is boring normally. And I didn't want it to be boring. I really wanted it to be, because I think actually the ideas are fascinating. And the possibilities, both in terms of intellectual possibilities, and for myself as a believing Muslim, just the potential ways in which this can impact gender reform in the Muslim world is large, and my desire to have this as something that Muslim feminists and Muslim reformers could work with was part of why I needed to make the writing interesting. Actually, I must give credit here where it's due. Ibrahim Musa, who actually came down to South Africa in a mentoring program with me, actually sat me down and made me read. And you might not believe this, reading Ibrahim's Ghazali work, which is quite dense for many people. But Ibrahim actually strongly recommended that I write in a narrative style. He actually literally gave me stuff to read and said, read this, look at the style of writing that's been done in this book. This is somebody writing on literature, and I want you to be able to think about how you might use that kind of language when you're writing your book. And so he really did mentor me in the most helpful of ways. And I just took the writing very seriously. And it really is a lot of labor to rewrite, because we've trained in very dry and boring styles of writing in academia. And so almost to retrain yourself and to tool yourself in a more creative style was part of the work that I had to do for the book. So part of this is both to make it a compelling read, which I'm hoping that it will be, but also to kind of give the reader a little taste of, to make the ideas, very complex ideas, accessible. And I think the creative writing helps to do that.
Yeah, I think you're very successful, and if for no other reason, I hope people will look at it for that, because I think it does make the content, which in this book you're dealing with very complex ideas, much more accessible. So you did a very good job. Now, in the beginning of the book, you outline some of the social and ritual consequences of spiritual equality or spiritual inequality, and you initiate our reflections on Islamic notions of the category of the human being and how this category is gendered. So you bring together both the kind of abstract philosophical concepts and then concrete daily relationships between men and women. And you frame this discussion in the introduction, at least, within two contemporary issues. One, the role of women leadership in the mosque and politics of the hijab. I'm wondering if you could talk about why you frame the conversation in this way and give us a little idea what these debates are about, what the implications might be. But really what you do very well in the book is you discuss kind of what these debates are leaving out and how we can begin to think about these in new ways.
Yes. Thank you, Christian. I think, one of the things that I'm responding to, I think, is another narrative when one is thinking about gender and Islam, the narrative that I find unsatisfactory, a narrative that men and women are spiritually equal but socially unequal. And so what I was doing in this introductory chapter was to take two issues that happen very much at the kind of social, everyday, public level and to say, well, here are issues that Muslims are dealing with, whether it's women's access to the masjid or women's ritual leadership, or whether it's questions of hijab and dressing. How are these debates that are everyday, very real, socially engaged, how one represents oneself in the public sphere, what are the ways in which women might or might not have access to leadership, what are the debates against? And to say, well, actually, these are not simply a question of, well, what does the tradition allow? But more importantly, it's a question of what kinds of narratives of human beings underlie these debates. Because truly, my own kind of encounter, as a graduate student here at the University of Cape Town, when I first did my master's here, I did it focusing on questions of nushuz. My actual thesis, I was very obsessed with this Quranic verse of 434, and I had spent a lot of time grappling with it, struggling with it. I had studied some pre-modern commentators on the verse itself, and I had actually done lots of interviews with Muslim women. And in all of these narratives on, you know, on violence against women and violence against wives, whether it was coming about out of readings of the text of the Quran around a verse that seemed to be speaking to this topic, or whether it was asking women how the imams in their particular context and at their masjids or the religious leaders were responding to the situation within their own family, it appeared to me that all of the struggles that one was encountering on this topic and many other topics was, at the end of the day, underlying all of the justifications for gender inequality was a certain kind of understanding of who's the human person. And for me, the deficit was at this level. The deficit, or what was unsatisfactory for me, was the ways in which ultimately all of these questions came down to a question of, what does it mean to be a human being within Islam? What is the relationship that each of us have to God? How does our relationship between men and women, between human beings, impact this, you know, impact our relationship with God? But how are these questions of what it means to be a human being enable certain kinds of gender practices and disenable or disable other kinds of gender practices? And so for me, the question was to get, you know, beyond the question of, you know, which parts of tradition say a woman can be a leader, and who says, you know, which Muslim thinkers say, you know, it's fine for a woman to be leading a mixed congregation, and which argue against it. Rather, it is what is it in our understandings of human beings that facilitate these kinds of debates? So just to clarify that, which may seem a little bit abstruse at the moment, for me, what I found compelling about Ibn Arabi was that when he makes a case, for example, about the question of mixed congregational leadership, his argument is not simply a question of who of his intellectual predecessors or scholarly predecessors make the case for or against. His argument is that men and women have been created spiritually equal and hence have the same access to this social, you know, this public, this area of public leadership. And so his argument goes straight down to the question of, well, what does it mean to be a human being? What access do we have to the fullness of human capacity in relationship to the Muslim tradition? And if Muslim men and women have that same access, then there's a direct translation of that into the social realm. So effectively, my desire was to connect the ways in which Muslims have imagined being human and what visions of being human are available to us within major, within the Quran, within other sources of tradition, and to grapple in our context with how that might help us to rethink some of the challenges of gender injustice or inequality that we might be confronting in the contemporary period in a variety of different contexts.
Now, these contesting positions on gender in many of these debates that you've been talking about are underpinned by certain assumptions about what human nature is, what existence is. And following Ibn Arabi, you kind of divide these into three realms, which you call anthropology, ontology, and cosmology. Can you kind of give us a little outline of structurally how these categories work and what you're trying to kind of demonstrate by using these?
Yeah, so when I use the category of religious anthropology, actually a category that's been used extensively within Christianity and Christian theology, but actually underpins a lot of the different debates within a variety of religions. So religious anthropology for me is a category that refers to asking some central questions about what does it mean to be a gendered human being? Does Islam provide the idea of a universal human essence? You know, is this something that men and women have the same access to? Are there differences? Do men and women have the same nature? How does this relate to one's relationship to God and to one's relationship to one another? So definitions of being human, intrinsically also provide meanings of what it means to be a framework to make sense of what it means to be gendered. And then I'd say, well, actually, it's not just religious anthropology. Religious anthropology is also situated in a kind of ontology. And an ontology, in a very kind of basic usage of the word, refers to a theory about what is the nature of reality or the nature of being. And it asks, you know, what is in the most kind of what actually exists? What is what is the nature of the human being? Who am I in relation to all of that which exists? And so the idea is that cosmology, religious cosmology or religious anthropology and ontology are two categories that interrelate with each other quite strongly. Now, within these questions on religious anthropology and ontology are always situated within a certain idea of the universe. You know, how is the universe created? What is the cosmology? How do human beings fit in within all of creation? What is the nature of the cosmos? How was it created? For what purpose? Towards what end? And within all of this, what is the purpose of human beings within such a cosmology? So the idea is to be thinking about the deep existential questions. Who am I as a human being? How am I situated in all of creation, in the cosmos? And what are my prerogatives as a human being? And how are these prerogatives impacted by whether I'm a man or a woman? And so all of these kind of very deep existential questions are not just abstract, but they have very specific implications for how one thinks about everyday gender politics when one is looking at it from the perspective of from a religious worldview. So I hope that's slightly helpful.
Yeah. Now, the other kind of very large component is you put Ibn Arabi in conversation with what you call Islamic feminism. And you, in the introduction, you kind of give a very specific perspective on what you believe Islamic feminism is and where it fits in the larger kind of philosophical tradition of feminist thought. I'm wondering if you could kind of give us a little bit of perspective on your ideas about Islamic feminism. And I really like how you divide this into awareness, activism, and vision as a specific way of kind of deploying a feminist perspective in the Islamic tradition. Could you talk about this a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. As many people that might be reading on Islamic feminism realize that even the category is open to a number of kind of contestations, and people are grappling with, well, what is this Islamic feminism? Do we use feminist language? There's a rethinking even of the terms of the debate. But at this point, I'm still comfortable. While I'm still grappling with some of these questions myself, as in the meantime, so to say, as we are in the process of rethinking these very categories, I'm fairly comfortable with this idea of an Islamic feminism that, or any feminism for that matter, that is this threefold approach to feminism, which is awareness, as you noted, activism, and a certain vision. And I think that, what would be different in Islamic feminism from potentially other forms of feminism, not different but perhaps distinctive, would be that Islamic feminism, in terms of the third part of that, this notion of a vision of, well, what is the idea of a human society based on principles of justice, equality, and freedom? What is human wholeness within this context as well? And so the Islamic feminism will provide potentially a very distinctive notion of what that notion of human wholeness might be. And the whole notion of, why it's important to use the term Islamic feminism, is open to debate and discussion. But I think, for those of us within the tradition that are committed to revisioning, and that are very committed to the tradition and to revisioning some of the ways in which Islam is thought about, both at the level of rethinking texts, but also in terms of reforming society, the notion of a kind of, a collaboration with other feminists, potentially people that we can talk to around. So essentially being Islamic feminist on the one hand means engaging with our tradition in a variety of ways. But what I like about using the term is that it also allows and facilitates the possibility of thinking through broader questions of gender justice in the societies that we're in. So, for example, I live in South Africa. I'm a Muslim, but I'm also South African, and I'm also very committed to be thinking very strongly around debates in my society that might not be directly related to the Muslim community, but to the South African community more broadly. And so the ways in which I think about feminism in relationship to Islam, I'm also somebody that is committed to a vision of gender equality more broadly in my society. And so how these critical tools of thinking through gender justice and articulating visions of human equality, you know, if one is using this language, there's a certain kind of sisterhood, if one can use that very kind of contested term, in a more nuanced way. So I think it's a helpful, you know, it's a helpful way to be situating, but it's not the only way. And it's something that I want to be clear that, you know, some people have great and legitimate difficulty with the term. And that's something that I completely respect.
Sure. Now, just for listeners, in the kind of first chapter, you go over some of the discussions of earlier Sufis, both kind of more philosophically, but also socially in issues of gender and marriage and sexuality, which I'm going to skip over, if that's okay with you, so we can kind of get more into Ibn Arabi's thought. And in the next chapter, you focus on this idea of Ibn Arabi's religious anthropology. And here, a lot of what you're doing is demonstrating how Ibn Arabi constructs notions of human nature in relation to this larger cosmology, and really getting at this idea of kind of spiritual potential, and how kind of gender is situated in relation to moral capacity. Can you walk us through briefly what Ibn Arabi says in relation to this idea of the human being?
Absolutely. I would like to respond before I go to that. If that's okay with you,
yes,
Christian.
Of course.
There's another aspect of feminism that I just wanted to very quickly relate. You know, your previous question that I feel like I haven't. There's a very important part that I've actually missed out. And that's the question of, so I'll get to the question of thinking about the human being in Ibn Arabi's map, but if I can just respond to this very, very quickly before we continue. You know, one of the reasons that I think also a feminist reading of the tradition is so important, an Islamic feminist reading of the tradition is so important, and I mean, this I outlined in the introduction, but I think that, you know, one of the things that is very valuable is that readings of the past or history, and I speak to, you know, to the ways in which Rita Gross, for example, a Buddhist scholar, speaks to how it's important to think about one's tradition as being both accurate and usable. And so to think about feminism as a way to retrieve aspects of one's tradition that have been either rendered marginal or invisible, and to bring that into the center of conversation. For me, what is very valuable in that feminist move of retrieving marginalized histories and retrieving images of gender and women that are not seen in the center of traditional discourse is to actually reclaim the nature of tradition itself, to say that tradition is not simply this one thing of this patriarchal kind of heritage. We also have within our tradition, you know, aspects that speak to a very different possibility or speak to very different kinds of understandings of gender. And so my desire to engage with the tradition as a feminist and to be reading for that which is historically has been rendered marginal, like a number of other Islamic feminists, is in part to make a claim for tradition, meaning that what I would like to do in this process is not to simply say the nature of the tradition is this one thing which is problematic, but rather the nature of tradition is multiple, and we can choose to engage with aspects of our tradition that in fact provide us with very rich resources and conversation pieces. Not in a way of simply abdicating to tradition where you say, well, actually tradition says X, therefore I need to follow it in a certain way, but rather to start a very rich conversation with parts of the tradition that have possibilities for us to retrieve different ways of being. And we have to speak to the past, otherwise, you know, we don't really think of ourselves in a kind of tradition. We part of what we inherit as contemporary Muslims, or what contemporary Muslims might inherit, is a variety of things. And I think part of locating yourself in that tradition and arguing for a different vision of that tradition often means that you have to engage with that tradition both critically and constructively. And part of the work that I want to do with Ibn Arabi is part of that creative, critical but creative engagement with things that have been not sufficiently engaged with in terms of gender equality. So I just wanted to make that point as something that I see that Islamic feminists can bring of value to the nature of tradition and to the debates in contemporary in contemporary scholarship.
And you do that very well in the book, and I think your argument for using Ibn Arabi in general is very convincing. So I hope people do get into the details of this.
Yes.
So in this relationship between kind of the macro and the microcosm, perhaps you could kind of situate this and, you kind of show how this is rendered into both legal and social realms. So perhaps you can kind of give us an idea of how this, his vision of kind of human nature in relation to cosmology and how it gets kind of sure. played out in the lived world.
Sure. So thank you for that question, Christiane. And so what I, when I started off this interview, I spoke to how I was so compelled by this vision of Ibn Arabi that I just found it quite a transporting thing to read him for the very first time. And part of that was we were reading texts on what it means, what is this human archetype that all human beings are to aspire to? And Ibn Arabi sets up this map and uses kind of great cosmological arguments about how human beings are effectively a microcosm of all of the divine attributes, and it's the one being that's being created, which is a distillation of, of all the divine attributes potentially in perfect harmony. So human beings are the only creation that have the potential capacity or the archetypal capacity to reflect all of the divine attributes in the perfect distilled manner. And that's the archetype that all human beings should try and aspire towards. The rest of creation, the macrocosm more broadly, these divine attributes are scattered and diffuse and reflected and manifested. The divine qualities are manifested in the rest of the cosmos in more diffuse ways. So all of creation in Ibn Arabi's cosmology is a reflection of the divine attributes, of all of God's attributes. Human beings are unique in their capacity to reflect all of them in one being, in a microcosmic way, in perfect harmony. And so this kind of imaginary of what, and this archetype is known as the complete human being, or insan al-kamil, the complete human being. And human beings, men and women, need to aspire to this spiritual, this distilled spiritual archetype that we all have within us as potential. Every human being can achieve that potential, irrespective of gender, race, any external differences, any differences of identity are entirely insignificant in this ultimate goal that human beings are to kind of aspire towards. So Ibn Arabi does that in very interesting ways, and not only just makes the case that men and women have this. One of the things that I also do in my book is speak about the ways in which he describes his female teachers and his female disciples. So not only does he have these very sophisticated and complex discussions on what it means to be a human being and this archetype of al-insan al-kamil that all human beings should aspire to, that's equally open to men and women alike, to all human beings. But he also speaks in a number of other of his writings of men and women that he engaged with that actually he speaks about how they've distilled certain attributes, how they've become masters of certain kinds of qualities. So he speaks about his teachers in very exemplary ways. He has these two teachers that he speaks about, and really gives us some very, very nuanced ways to understand how it is that he actually observed these very, well advanced teachers. One of his teachers was, a woman called Yasmina Umm al-Fuqara, and he speaks about her. And I've got a description, if I can find it very quickly, and the kind of description he uses about her when he speaks about her, and I've just found it here, which says, "Among people of our kind, I've never met one like her." Here he's speaking, people of our kind are people on the spiritual path. So he says, "Among people of our kind, I have never met one like her with respect to the control she had over her soul. In her spiritual activities and communications, she was the greatest. She had a strong and pure heart, a noble spiritual power, and a fine discrimination. She was endowed with many graces, and I had considerable experience of her intuition and found her to be a master in this sphere. Her spiritual state was characterized chiefly by her fear of God and his good pleasure in her. The combination of the two at the same time in one person being extremely rare among us." So I'm just using this to show that it wasn't simply that he was creating a kind of theoretical archetype. When he speaks about a number of women, and men for that matter. But what for me is very interesting is that when he speaks about these spiritual capacities, his reference points are men and women alike. And having had two female teachers when he was a fairly young person, he speaks about them. But he also has extensive descriptions on his female disciples, all of whom, you know, there's one that gets a fairly, negative spin. But the rest of them that he speaks about have extremely positive qualities. So on the one hand, he has this kind of discussion, but on the of what human beings are able to do. And then when he speaks about particular Sufis and particular spiritual teachers and particular people that are on the spiritual path, one has a very clear sense that these are things that men and women alike have access to, have realized, are in the process of realizing, and share fundamentally as the deepest existential prerogative for human beings, men and women alike. And so I find that very compelling. But the other part that I find quite compelling when you're looking at Ibn Arabi, and I spend quite a few chapters working through the complexity of his arguments, but I'm just going to present, if that's okay with you, Christian, just some of the ways in which, for example, he takes things that were kind of normal in his time and morphs them, kind of dominant narratives about men and women. So, of course, one of the kind of central narratives around men and women that's part of his, the part of what's taken for granted in his context, is the notion, for example, of the creation story of Eve from Adam, of Hawa from Adam. And there's how we, for those of you that know some of the Muslim feminist literature, we know that the Quran, for example, doesn't really speak about this at all. There are no mention of ribs in the Quran, but they come in fairly enthusiastically at the hadith level. And so we have this notion amongst Ibn Arabi's cohorts, the notion that women are created from the rib of Adam is part of what is taken, and this is drawn from the hadith literature, is seen as being a very normative part of how one makes sense of male-female relationships. Another kind of part of that discourse, or what was accepted, was this notion of the crooked rib and all of the kind of associations with deficiency and defect that the notion of a crooked rib might have. And what Ibn Arabi does, I think, very beautifully, is on the one hand, he uses, he takes these narratives that are there, and he doesn't discount them. He doesn't say these hadith are inaccurate or wrong, or, these are weak hadith, which is some of the arguments that Muslim feminists have made. But he simply goes with this hadith, and the way in which he presents an interpretation of this hadith really very gently completely morphs the understanding of what ribs might mean. So, for example, he would say, she's created from the short rib of Adam, but then he adds that this in this rib, then his discussion of the rib is that really it is the epitome, it is the choicest part of Adam, and it reflects everything that's in Adam. So he takes something that has generally been talked about as crooked and deficient and what reflects a lack in women, and morphs the interpretation of that rib into something about sameness. But not only does he do that, he says, what is this rib-like nature? The rib-like nature is something that allows women to bend in inclination towards her husband and children. This rib nature is because she's created from Adam, and so there's a kind of oneness. They both come from one another, and so they yearn for one another. And then he adds, and the man also inclines towards the woman. So the rib nature of the woman is about bending and inclination. And then in his next line, the man also inclines towards the woman with a bending towards himself because she is a part of him. So the rib then becomes about yearning and desire for one another. It's very much embedded in a kind of dominant narrative of Adam being the source and Eve being derivative, but while he's working with that imaginary, he's simultaneously morphing it into something quite different from deficit to one of inclination, sameness. And so its hierarchy is still there, but it's romanticizing and eliminating some of the misogyny. And that's the one level at which he works with what is the dominant imaginary. So when you read this, when I first read it, I thought, this is all very nice Ibn Arabi, but it's still quite hierarchical and I really have problems with it. And you're just romanticizing an image and making it something else, but I'm really not very happy with you. And then I read on, of course, and as in Ibn Arabi's typical mode, we come across his writing somewhere else. And here he presents us with four models of creation. He says, there's Adam created, and then we have the notion of Adam, just being created, and then Eve is created from Adam. But then we also have Jesus being created, and we have this notion of Jesus' creation from Mary. So then he makes this kind of really interesting analogy where Eve comes from Adam and Jesus comes from Mary. And he says, well, in the same way that you have a woman coming from a man, you now have a man being born from a woman without the intermediary of a partner of the opposite sex, so to say. And then he argues, so he gives you this thing, and in some sense there's now suddenly this balance of this creation model where you no longer simply have a woman coming from a man, but you have a different model of Jesus, who's a man, who's created through Mary and without there being a man involved in his creation as a counterpoint to Eve's creation to Adam. And then he goes merrily along and tells us, you know, well, all of these anyhow, these creations of Eve from Adam and Mary from Jesus are exceptions. The rest of us are created from men and women alike. And so what I like about what he does is that he presents you with the dominant narrative. He doesn't say that narrative is not there and should be discounted. He works it, he morphs it, he changes it, he works within it while changing it. Then he gives you other narratives which actually say, well, you know, Adam and Eve is one myth to be thinking about human beings and how they and the relationship between men and women. Mary and Jesus gives you another model. But actually, guys, just, you know, don't worry too much about that. The rest of us come from men and women alike. And so this is a real kind of, you know, it's a saying what would be called in some of the literature in mysticism, particularly, of course, Michael Sells, who comes with, you know, some of the most beautiful analysis of ways in which mystics do this process of unsaying, of both saying and unsaying things. He gives you the dominant narrative. He says, if you want to use that language, he articulates or reiterates the dominant narrative. And then through these very paradoxical moves and these stories that bring ambivalence and contradiction into play, unsays the dominant imaginary and opens up spaces for us to grapple in very real terms with other possibilities. And so when you have it's not just thesis, antithesis. It's the multiplicity and the way in which things are both are played with and morphed that create ways for us not to get stuck in any single conceptual paradigm that we might have, either of God or of men and women alike. And that's what I find so incredibly liberating about Ibn Arabi. I just find it such an expansive way to engage. You know, so he has these myths. He has these notions of Adam and Eve, and you know all of the rib stories that we have, and then we find, on the other hand, these very powerful images of women coming across. This very, you know, these kind of deep ontological notions. I mean, he has this one kind of quote where he says, "There is nothing in the created universe," and I quote, "greater in power than women, and this is a secret known only by those knowledgeable about how the universe came into existence, and with what motion God brought into the universe." Existence. And then he, unquote, and then he goes on to say something about how women reflect something of the divine essence, that which is feminine. And he looks at the Arabic and he says, well, this is feminine. It's something. And the femininity of the language, the grammatical feminine, is actually a signifier of something ontological, actually. And by far my favorite way in which he engages with questions in a very subversive but really profound way, is this one particular discussion he has when he's talking about God's attribute of strength, al-qawi. And so there's this, and I have to read this, and I'll read it slowly and just talk about it a little bit, just because I find it so interesting. He says, and I quote, "So God informs us about what strength He specifically appoints to her." Okay, well, let me just contextualize this very quickly. Okay, so, you know, there was some kind of controversy in the life of the prophet, and the two wives of the prophet, Aisha and Hafsa, had aligned themselves, and there was, you know, there's discussions about what this issue was, whether it was the fact that the prophet spent too much time with one of his other wives. But be that as it may, there was a controversy in the house of the prophet, and these two wives of his were unhappy with him. And so there's a Quranic revelation about that. And he invokes this Quranic revelation when he's discussing the attribute of al-qawi. So here are two, in effect, women that the Quran, when we look at this verse, is actually reprimanding, because the Quran says, if you back each other up against him, the prophet, then indeed God is his guardian, and Gabriel and the righteous believers and the angels after them are his supporters, meaning Muhammad's supporters. So the Quran is effectively reprimanding these two wives of the prophet who are clearly, you know, in opposition to him and causing some problems and giving him a bit of a headache. And Ibn Arabi's reflection on this is what he says. he looks at this Quranic verse and he says there's something about the strength of women that's being reflected, something of the attribute of al-qawi that is evident in this interchange and in this Quranic revelation. And in his reflection on this verse, he says, all of this to counter the strength of two women, and God mentions only the strong ones who possess power and strength. So the righteous believers act with conviction, and that is the strongest of actions. And if you understand this, you have set off well on the path. So he takes a situation where these two wives are being reprimanded. And on the surface, it's really kind of really they're behaving out of order. But what he does is he says, you know, God has to invoke all this help to the prophet just against his two women. God has to back him up, and the angels have to back him up, and the righteous believers, and all of this stuff just against two women, which is really a signifier of how strong women are. And so he doesn't use it as a recrimination against Aisha and Hafsa. He uses it to say, and it becomes a model for the believers. So those of you that understand what strength of action and conviction is about, here's an instance for you to learn from these women who are manifesting al-Qawi. A very kind of subversive reading of something that is, you know, that on the surface can mean very different things. And so I think those kinds of ways in which Ibn Arabi unsays and unpicks the seams of traditional understandings of gender relationships is very powerful, and is why I find him a very interesting conversation partner and a very interesting kind of friendship to have with a thinker that I think is a very expansive thinker and that enables and almost asks us to engage with him in a specific, you know, in this manner.
Yeah, and in the book, there's so many really creative and interesting narratives like this, which we haven't even scratched the surface. But we have taken a lot of your time, and I'm sure a lot of people are eager to hear about what you're working on now, or perhaps what you have coming out in the future.
At the moment, one of the things that I'm doing, despite what I think was a lot of work in making this book accessible, making Ibn Arabi's ideas accessible, at least some of his ideas, of course, it's just a drop in the ocean because, you know, I've really just dealt with such a small portion of his work. Part of what I'm doing, there are two things that I'm doing. Part of this is to try and write these in even more accessible ways because, you know, there are still people that have read the book and said to me, this is great, you've got me interested in this, but I'm still struggling to understand these ideas. So part of my own commitment is to make a lot of this even more accessible to the extent that I'm able to, and I'm trying to write in ways that are even more accessible. So that's just part of what I would consider translation work, not a language translation, but translation of ideas in ways that open it up to different kinds of audiences. The other project that I'm thinking through, and it's I've started working on two other projects. One is I've come back to Ghazali, and I am now kind of going through some of his works and, you know, opened up the old box, my own PhD dissertation box, and I'm looking at him. So I've been kind of thinking through some of those ideas, and I hope to publish some stuff on Ghazali. And the other project that I'm very interested in is to be thinking about in a more contemporary way, Sufism and social justice ethics, to be thinking about Sufi ethics in relationship to questions of social justice more broadly. And that's a project that myself and Scott Kugel, for example, one of my colleagues and friends, we've been kind of working on what a project like that might look like and how we might kind of define the contours of a Sufism and social ethics project.
Great. Those sound wonderful. Well, Sadia, thank you for sharing your time with us. It was really great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Christiane. It was a pleasure and truly joyful to be able to speak to you.
That was my conversation with Sadia Sheikh about Sufi narratives of intimacy, Ibn Arabi, gender, and sexuality, which was published with University of North Carolina Press in 2012. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.